WBAI.org.
Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 42 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 62, and it will be sunny this Monday, April 26, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI New York. Coming up next, a new day. Puerto Rican community is demanding this week an end to the institutional neglect of the Center for Puerto Rican Studies and support for the center's library and archives, CUNY's crown jewel. The center is a uniquely innovative university-based research institute located at Hunter College at the City University of New York. And it's dedicated to the interdisciplinary study and interpretation of the Puerto Rican experience in the United States. And this morning, we'll speak to Professor Blanca Vasquez. Professor Vasquez is a retired associate professor in film and media studies. She worked at Hunter College for the last 16 years. She joined the Centro's Oral History Task Force in 1983 and was the founding editor of the Center Journal during its first 10 years. Stay tuned for headlines. How sweet it would be if I Good morning once again. This is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. Authorities in India announced 349,691 new cases on Sunday, April 25th, another record for a single country since the start of the pandemic. India also reported 2,767 deaths, also a daily record, as a surge of cases has pushed the government to organize special trains to get oxygen supplies to worst-hit cities. Indian authorities also report that these numbers are much worse due to undercounting. This catastrophe unfolding in India appears to be the worst-case scenario that many feared from the COVID-19 pandemic. India is unable to find sufficient hospital beds, access to tests, medicines, or oxygen. The country of over 1.4 billion people is sinking beneath the weight of infections. Dr. D.K. Baluja, medical superintendent of New Delhi's Jaipur Golden Hospital, discussed 20 COVID-19 deaths that occurred overnight. On April 23rd, he said, quote, "Our supply of oxygen was delayed by 7 to 8 hours on Friday night, and the stock we received last night, April 24th, is only 40% of the required supply," unquote. The U.S. and the European Union have promised to rapidly deploy aid to beleaguered healthcare workers in India, where there has been a fourth straight day of world record COVID-19 cases. And black people were fatally shot by white officers in at least two states in the 24 hours after jurors found that former police officer Derek Chauvin murdered an unarmed Derek Floyd during an arrest. Protests are building to get justice for these recently killed black people by white police officers. A day after black 16-year-old female child Makia Bryant was shot and killed by a white Columbus, Ohio police officer, demonstrations spread throughout the city as protesters demanded police accountability. And during a vigil for Makia Bryant's life on Wednesday night, April 21st, local organizer Hannah Abdur-Rahim called for abolition of the police system. He said, quote, "The system is not broken. There's no cracks in the system. The system was designed for white supremacy. The system was designed perfectly. We need to design a new one," unquote. And on Wednesday, April 21st, the day of Makia Bryant's vigil, Andrew Brown, a black 42-year-old man from Elizabeth City, North Carolina, a city of approximately 18,000 people, was shot dead by a white deputy sheriff trying to serve a warrant. An eyewitness said that Brown was attempting to drive away, but was shot dead in his car. As of 8 p.m. Friday, Raleigh police officials declared the Brown protest an unlawful assembly after they say dozens impeded the flow of traffic by tossing trash cans in the street as around 40 people marched through the city toward Glenwood South.
I want everybody to hear this. We as the council, we have met tonight, and we want to assure the citizens of Elizabeth City, as well as this nation, that we will not tolerate any injustice in Elizabeth City.
And yesterday, right here in New York City, a coalition of organizations, including NYSNA, the New York State Nurses Association, Asians for Black Lives, Asians for Abolition, Word Up Books, the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home, May Day Space, and many others, organized what they called an Uptown March in solidarity with Asian lives. A black, brown, white, and Asian solidarity march. The marchers, protesters, marched in Washington Heights, Harlem, and East Harlem against anti-Asian violence. The planning of the march coincided with the most recent attack in Harlem of a 61-year-old Yao Pan Ma, who's currently fighting for his life at Harlem Hospital. Ma's niece says that Yao Pan immigrated to New York City just 2 years ago. He moved to Harlem after their Chinatown apartment burned down, and he recently lost his job to COVID. It was while he was collecting cans to help support his family that he was brutally attacked on 125th Street and 3rd Avenue. Here are some sounds from the demonstration yesterday.
Fred Ho would play concerts right on this street corner.
Woo!
Yuri Kuchiyama marched up and down these streets, stood on this corner with Brother Malcolm X, lived and raised her children a few blocks from here. Can we say all power to sisters Yuri Kuchiyama?
All power for sister Yuri Kuchiyama.
And to Fred Ho. But here's what's important, brothers and sisters. Here's what we know about that grassroots organizing. Here's what we know from the legacy of the Black Panther Party, from Ewok Hume, from the Young Lords, from Rising Up Angry, from the Patriot Party. We've got to be on the ground in the communities every day. It's not enough that we're aware. It's not enough that we march. It's not enough that we boycott. People who have been brainwashed the system have to be educated by our presence, and organized around programs, liberation programs. They've got to see us each day. They've got to see this rainbow. Our young people have to be out working in these community programs, in these liberation programs, whether it's around health, whether it's around hunger, whether it's around housing, whether it's around the ability to walk safely in the community. This rainbow can't disappear today. It can't just be put up on social media. It can't just be talked about. We have to have this defiant revolutionary wall that says all power to the people all of the time.
Woo!
That coalition and of class struggle that we understand will topple the system, we have to be those long distance revolutionaries that are in the communities. Can we do that?
Yes.
Can we fight?
Yes.
Can we fight?
Yes.
Can we educate?
Yes.
Can we liberate?
Yes.
Can we end this violence against our Asian brothers and sisters?
Yes.
Can we understand that a slap against one of our Asian brothers and sisters is a punch, a knife wound, or a bullet wound to all of us? So we stand in solidarity today, now, and forever. All power to the people.
All power to the people. Woo!
And that was Jamal Joseph, veteran Black Panther and a professor at Columbia University of Film, speaking to the crowd that gathered at 125th Street and Adam Clayton Powell at the State Office Building. The demonstration was robust, an enormous amount of media presence at the demonstration, many different speakers, Rachel Hu from the Answer Coalition, Diana Ho of Abolition, Asians for Abolition, Immortal Technique came through, the hip-hop artist who was born in Harlem, Afro-Peruvian, and many others were there. Marcos Maldonado Cruz, our producer, was holding it down with tech and audio. It was really a beautiful gathering. Mariposa, the poet of New York City, the magisterial poet, did a beautiful job in front of the People's Church in East Harlem. We had Perry Young, a musician and one of the actors in the show Warrior on HBO, performed. It was just a beautiful gathering. Folks who were cheering us in the streets were delighted to take our literature. Mayday Space was in the house, Josh Carrera. It was just a show of solidarity and what we need more of. And the story of the man who was brutalized in Harlem is just devastating. Again, that is the 61-year-old Yao Pan Ma, who's currently fighting for his life at Harlem Hospital. And we were told that he immigrated to New York 2 years ago, moved to Harlem after his Chinatown apartment burned down, and he recently lost his job to COVID. And it was while he was collecting cans to help support his family that he was attacked. And I would like to read from the statement that was published by the coalition, the robust coalition that put this demonstration together. In New York City, violence against Asians and Pacific Islanders has risen by 1,900% over the course of the pandemic. That's 1,900%. And here are excerpts of that statement written by the coalition that sponsored the Uptown March. And it reads, attacks against Asians and Pacific Islanders today are in large part a product of U.S. imperial competition with China and the blaming of China for the COVID-19 pandemic. But anti-Asian violence has a long history. Its genesis is linked to the super exploitation in the late 1800s of Chinese labor to build the U.S. railroad, the exclusion of Asians from the concept of America, placement of Japanese Americans and their immigrant parents and grandparents in U.S. concentration camps during World War II, and anti-communism have reinforced this violence. Millions of our Asian, African, Caribbean, and Latin American immigrant parents are here because the U.S. military has intervened and occupied our countries. Anti-Asian violence in the United States is an extension of the savagery of U.S. imperialist wars in the Philippines, Vietnam, Korea, and elsewhere in Asia, which have produced mass displacement and trauma. Wherever there is war, women, girls, and femmes are conquered by soldiers through rape. The March 16, 2021 killing of six Asian women by a white supremacist in Atlanta is directly tied to their structural dehumanization as exoticized sex objects. Under distinct but related conditions, black women, girls, and femmes were raped during their enslavement in this country. Racial capitalism is at the heart of exploitation at home and abroad. We reject carceral responses to recent attacks. The U.S. government is using the Atlanta shootings to justify expansion of police power, but the police exists to protect private property and originally functioned to catch escaped slaves. As agents of white supremacy, police will never safeguard black, brown, indigenous, and Asian communities. The carceral state props up a global system of racial capitalism through artificial borders, cages of detention, and a culture of control and repression. We must work to create real safety in our communities and foster a belief in the sanctity of life. We reject, too, the detention of border crossers everywhere, knowing that the Page Act and the Chinese Exclusion Act in the late 19th century set the mold for contemporary U.S. anti-immigrant policy. We stand united across race, ethnicity, and gender in the face of those who seek to divide us. Those who profit by dispossessing people from their lands, exploiting labor, and extracting resources do so by sowing divisions among working people of different races, ethnicities, genders, and sexualities who share class interests and are bonded by their common humanity. State-sponsored propaganda that pits us against each other and the erosion of public resources that leaves us squabbling over crumbs are to blame. We are proud heirs of a radical tradition of solidarity that includes Frederick Douglass's opposition to the Chinese Exclusion Act and Yuri Kochiyama's fierce and loving work alongside Malcolm X. When we undertake this work and recognize our common enemy, we are a real threat to those in power. And those were words and excerpts from the statement produced by the coalition that led a demonstration in New York City yesterday against anti-Asian violence and denouncing the rise by 1,900% of anti-Asian violence in New York City. This is over the course of the pandemic, and the demonstration marched from Washington Heights through Harlem and ended in East Harlem. And this weekend, we also celebrated the birthday of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and a very, very loud and large group of folks from all over the Northeastern Corridor gathered in Philadelphia on Mumia's birthday, Saturday, April 24th, to demand his immediate release. Mumia Abu-Jamal is the imprisoned radio journalist, veteran Black Panther, and freedom fighter, who is known as the voice of the voiceless. He is a political prisoner, one of dozens of political prisoners from the 60s era, who continue to be imprisoned, and folks gathered to say free Mumia, free Russell Maroon Schultz, another political prisoner in Pennsylvania, and free all political prisoners in the United States. It was another just phenomenal gathering of people fighting not just around the life and freedom of Mumia, but fighting against police brutality and the violence of incarceration, and demanding that all prisoners over the age of 50 be immediately released from prison. And it's also important to note that Mumia randomly called me yesterday during the protest, at the start of the protest in Washington Heights, and I patched him to that very large crowd that gathered there in Washington Heights at Mitchell Square Park. So it was a glorious day. Mumia, of course, is in a hospital. He's recovering from heart surgery, but he spoke to this crowd at Mitchell Square in Washington Heights, and it was glorious. And it's 7:22 and 43 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez with a voice that's a little exhausted this morning because I've been out in the streets. Your host of A New Day. And that was Puerto Rico by Eddie Palmieri with Ismael Quintana. And a new coalition has been meeting for months now. It calls itself the Save Centro Coalition, and Centro refers to the Center for Puerto Rican Studies, El Centro de Estudios Puertorriqueños, which is housed at Hunter College. It includes the Centro Library and Archives, CUNY's crown jewel. The center is a uniquely innovative university-based research institute dedicated to the interdisciplinary study and interpretation of the Puerto Rican experience in the United States. And the coalition is calling for a seat at the table in matters impacting the center's future and a seat in meetings to secure the appropriate state and city funding required for Centro to function as the world-class institution that it is. And we welcome this morning to speak to us about what's going on, including an action that's happening uptown tomorrow, Blanca Vasquez, who's a retired associate professor in film and media studies. Professor Vasquez worked at Hunter College for the last 16 years. She joined the Centro's Oral History Task Force in 1985 and was the founding editor of the Centro Journal during its first 10 years. She served on PSC CUNY's Executive Council from 2014 to 2020, and that's the union of faculty CUNY at the City University of New York, and is a veteran of many community struggles, including the Justice Committee of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights that fought police killings and abuse of power during the Giuliani era. Blanca Vasquez, Professor Vasquez, welcome to A New Day.
Thank you, Professor Fernandez. And I was an adjunct, by the way, associate professor in film and media studies after my Centro years.
Correction, an adjunct professor for many, many years. That's just a reminder that were it not for adjunct professors, the City University of New York wouldn't run, literally. So can you give us a sense of the history of the Center for Puerto Rican Studies? When did it come into existence and how?
Well, you know, I was, an undergraduate, right, at City College in 1968-69, which was when students there took over the school demanding Black and Puerto Rican studies. Same thing was happening at Brooklyn College, right? Students took over. Some nascent faculty, and it was through those struggles that those departments were created. Part of the reclamo, right, or part of the demands was also to create this institute or Center for Puerto Rican Studies, which would do a number of things, including, you know, sort of create materials that would feed into these classes. And students were involved in those early struggles. Columbia University students, CUNY students, community members. This was a period of time when the community was very active and actually in the process of beginning to create, you know, many of the major institutions we have today, right? We created in the 60s and 70s. So the Centro came about as a result of occupations and of demands and of a community struggle for a place in the university. There was no place in the university, not only for students, but also for us as a subject matter, right? So the Centro comes out of those struggles and grew and developed, you know, over the years. It's now a 50-year history. And it is a unique resource. I mean, that's what has happened over the 50 years of its existence. And when we found out sort of suddenly that the director was leaving back in December, that's when we started to, we as people in the community and concerned about Centro, Centro has always been this resource that also serves community, not just you know, students, not just graduate students or and undergraduate students. We found out that not only was the director leaving quickly, but that the chief librarian position hadn't been filled for 3 years, that the archivist, the chief archivist, was about to retire now in March. He just retired. And so we saw that we began to ask questions about what was happening to central resources and central funding. And that's when the community became very alarmed that lines had been lost. We found out that central positions not filled. And so we called a meeting. The very first meeting, public meeting, was February 4th. And like over 100 people came. I mean, the response was enormous. Now that folks have been alerted, you know, that there was a danger, right, to one of our critical institutions. So we've been mobilized ever since, holding a series of public meetings and formed some working committees all about revitalizing the center, not just restoring funds that have been cut and lines that have disappeared, but revitalizing, because the center is actually more important than ever. It's already developed into this key resource to study, if you want to study the Puerto Rican reality. But it's an important site at this particular time in our history.
And it's really a jewel. I would not have been able to write my book on the Young Lords without the resources of El Centro, but not just the resources, the people who work there, have worked there for so many years, who are in carry this institutional memory of Puerto Ricans in New York and are connected to networks that are incredibly useful and vital for researchers and writers. Can you talk to us a little bit about the collection? What's in it? Talk to us about its richness.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was recently speaking to one of the founders, I guess, of the Central Library, Amilcar Tirado Aviles, who's now at the University of Puerto Rico Library. And so we were talking about that history and how, you know, the Central had evolved or had started with work areas, right? History and migration, what became task forces, history and migration, culture and the arts, language policy. We even had initially higher education was always a focus, of course. We had a prison task force. So the center had these areas of work. And initially what the library staff was doing was actually beginning to, for the first time, amass materials related to Puerto Rico in different archives. For example, they were looking at early labor history. They would go to the Samuel Gompers Library. And developed the very first guides, right, to materials related to Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans in the Samuel Gompers Library, so on and so forth. So what they began to do was just amass, right, all of this information that were in all different kinds of places, right, began to collect dissertations. So what was initially a support group for those work areas really became a multifaceted, right, collection of materials to do with Puerto Ricans, you know, in all areas of work, right? I remember when I was a staff person, it was just such a wonderful feeling to walk through the stacks, right, of the Central Library and just see, you know, how much material was there. When we started the Central Journal, right, and every issue was organized around a particular theme, right? So we did women and we did education and we did labor struggles and we did to double media issues, we could go to the Central Library and we could pull out, you know, materials, articles, historical material, photographs. It was there, right? It's the one place where all of this material is deposited, which is why if you're going to do, right, a dissertation as you did, right, or undergraduate work, I mean, this is the place you go if it touches upon Puerto Ricans. It's grown into a unique collection. I think it may be the most important repository in the world right now for materials related to Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans. The UPR Library, for example, which is a tremendous resource, does not, for example, collect all the material on the diaspora communities, right, that the Centro does. Because the Centro starts as New York, but it really then becomes a national archive. Which is why, within a couple of weeks of that first public meeting, right, Professor Aldo Laudio Santiago, working with other academics, wrote a petition, right, demanding to restore the Centro's resources and missions. Within 2 weeks, over 1,100 people had signed that petition. Academics across the country, in Puerto Rico, community members, students. It's now up to like 1,900 people. So academics and students immediately recognized the threat to the library and archives and the importance of that collection. It's become the one place where everyone donates their papers, where organizations deposit their records. So the Centro has the records not only of the Office of Migration of Puerto Rico, so it has those government records that have to do with migration, but it has the records of OSPIDA, of the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights, of the National Puerto Rican Business and Marketing Association. I didn't even know they existed, right? Of the Committee Against Repression, which worked on political prisoners. So in whatever sort of area of life you're doing research in, you can go to the Central Library and find the relevant material on Puerto Ricans. It's so critical that actually the NEH, right, National Endowment for Humanities, just granted the Centro almost $350,000 to digitize the materials that we have on culture, cultural production, and the arts, right? So they recognize the importance, criticalness of that collection. And yet, there's no chief librarian at the Centro, and there hasn't been one for 3 years, right? So that's intolerable, right, that a national, you know, entity can understand the uniqueness and importance of the collection, and yet we come back to CUNY and Hunter, right, and in a position as critical chief librarian is not filled for this long. And we were concerned that the chief archivist, who's left now, that must be filled. You cannot maintain a collection without having, you know, your critical people in place. So that was the alarm. That's what got everybody up in arms. You know, what is happening to our beloved Centro? And it has mobilized everyone.
Well, as you're speaking, I'm thinking that this has pretty large resonances for the island of Puerto Rico and its relationship to the United States as a colony. One of the structures of colonial domination is, in fact, stripping people of their history and culture. So it's shocking. It shocks the conscience that CUNY, which is supposed to safeguard the histories of working people of New York City, and we know that the Puerto Rican community and the Puerto Rican working class is integral to the history of New York City, that CUNY, right, in the era of Black Lives Matter, is not prioritizing El Centro. Given that we know that this is the first thing that the colonizer attacks is culture and history. So can you give us a sense of the colonial character of Puerto Rico? Why do people say that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States?
You know, one of the very first things the Centro produces, and I think it's back in probably 79. It was before I had reached there. But before I had actually started to work at Centro, I would go to the talleres and the public workshops they would have around history and culture. One of the first things the Centro produces is Labor Migration Under Capitalism, right, which is its first major book and a very, you know, sort of critical analysis. Because, you know, one of the questions, right, the reason we had a History and Migration Task Force is that the first work areas of the Centro are actually set by the questions and the demands, right, the community was making. And one of them is, what are we doing here? Right? Why are we citizens of the U.S.? Right? I mean, what does that mean? You know, and why are we facing this level of, you know, exclusion and discrimination and racism, you know, here, right, on this side? right? Because, I mean, there's a whole history of Puerto Ricans having to, in the early Pionero period, 20s and 30s, right, having to, like, organize, to go to government agencies, to tell them, to make sure that they knew that Puerto Ricans were citizens of the U.S. and therefore entitled, you know, to whatever rights, you know, because people would think of us as immigrants, right? So, anyway, that labor migration under capitalism actually does this analysis of what the relationship is and what the political economy is and how rapidly, you know, when the U.S. came in, how rapidly, you know, they took land ownership, right, and reorganized the Puerto Rican economy into, you know, sugar plantations. So there's a – this colonial history is what marks our experience, right, from – Spanish-American, right, from Spanish colonialism to American colonialism, and also, of course, the suppression of the independence movement. You know, so the Central begins by actually, you know, working on that analysis, right, and what propels a migration, you know, and what, and how that migration is structured, right, as a solution to the so-called excess population, right? So Central has been working on that, you know, from the very beginning, you know, understanding critically, you know, what we're here and what that relationship is. And it's, you know, just to make the full circle. I mean, this is a critical period of time, you know, for that relationship, right, to be on the table in a very different way, you know, given what's happened, you know, not only the economic collapse of, you know, the Commonwealth model, you know, but and the withdrawal of the so-called, you know, economic support. You know, so the hurricane, you know, 3 years mm-hmm. ago, which furthered that collapse, the imposition of a fiscal board in Puerto Rico that's not elected and not accountable to the people of Puerto Rico. You know, so it's a critical time, you know, for us to be understanding and looking at that relationship. I mean, people are up for some very serious discussion about it. So, yeah, it's an important time. You know, and it's an important time for the kinds of materials and history and, you know, that the Central Library has, which informs, I think, everything we do, right? It informs because it just addresses all our areas of life, whether we're the issues in education, the issues in political status, the issues in migration, the, you know, all of those issues are informed by the library and archive resources.
You're listening to the voice of Blanca Vasquez, retired adjunct associate professor in film and media studies. She worked at Hunter College for the last 16 years. She joined the Centro's Oral History Task Force in 1983 and was the founding editor of the Centro Journal in its first 10 years. And we're talking about the Coalition to Save the Centro, the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. And you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And the number to call with questions or comments, or maybe you are someone who relies on the Centro for your work, or you visited the library just to read up on the history of Puerto Rico, call us at 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Where do you fall in this conversation? 212-209-2877. You know, I remember reading that book, Labor Migration Under Capitalism, and it really became my Bible as I was writing my dissertation. And of course, I used it in my book extensively, but that is such a jewel for understanding the colonial project of the United States in Puerto Rico, but also the fallout in terms of the mass transfer of a third of the people of the island of Puerto Rico to cities like New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia after Operation Bootstrap, the industrialization project of the United States in Puerto Rico in 1947, which led to this mass displacement of Puerto Ricans to the U.S. mainland. Can you tell us a little bit about your own story and and how you became a professor. You were one of the first professors, Puerto Rican professors, in the United in the U.S. mainland, right? After the civil rights and Black Power movements and the movements of the 60s. Tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be Blanca Vasquez.
Well, I must say I have a hybrid identity because although and I love teaching, by the way, I was an adjunct professor for like 15 years. I never actually considered myself a professor, right? And it was interesting because that's also part of the Centro's, the initial, you know, ideology of the Centro, which was that, you know, CUNY was a space that we belonged in, right? I'm actually a graduate of CCMY, but I'm a graduate of, I always used to say it was like the college my parents could afford, which was tuition free, right? You know, City University of New York. So I actually had the benefit, and I wish everyone did, of what free tuition means. Because it means that you can go in and you can study and you can explore, you know, and you have the time, right, to dedicate to that without the burden of that first you have to work and earn, you know, enough money to pay your rent, buy your food, and pay tuition, and buy books, right, everything else. I frankly would love to see, you know, City University tuition free again. Anyway, so I had an excellent education, right, actually in the New York public school system in Brooklyn. And at City University of New York, you know, I've gone through various different careers and came back to CUNY, at the Centro. I had just graduated from actually the Columbia School of Journalism, right? And I came to the Centro because they were projecting the oral history project, an oral history of the Puerto Rican migration. And I came to work on that project, which was also going to have a number of, you know, public components, right? Because the Centro, ideologically, and this was true for the, you know, Black Studies programs that were started at the time and eventually Women's Studies, you know, they were connected to social movements, right? And they were structured to also then respond to the needs and the demands of those social movements, right? So when I get to Centro, you know, the Centro was about 10 years old at that point. Right, so there were still students, there were full-time research directors and research associates, right? Each task force was staffed, and always public events because the Centro had those very close ties to community, you know, organizations and to community needs. So I felt very comfortable, you know, at Centro. You know, it just wasn't a place where those sort of academic, right, I don't know, snobbery, you could say, on some level, right? That sort of academics are different from the people. You know, the Centro never had that formulation. And in fact, the Centro slogan was aprender a luchar, luchar es aprender, right? Mm. So that you learn to struggle, right? And the struggling itself is a process of learning, right? It's through struggle that you actually learn. And for a colonial people to confront your reality, struggle is a very critical part of learning, right? So the Centro, Labor Migration Under Capitalism, was also a book that actually changes the way I think about, right, our relationship, you know, to the United States and to the island, you know, especially for those of us from here, right, whose formation is here. And the big picture is so critical, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have that larger picture to understand where you fit in it. So the Centro Blanca, always informed the way that I understand, you know, not only being Puerto Rican, you know, but what is up for us as a colonial people, you know.
Blanca, we have a number of callers, and we should take them.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll take a number of them simultaneously. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi. Good morning. This is Jose Alfaro. I'm wondering if, Blanca, could you talk a little bit more about the role you think the Centro could play today in helping to deepen and build the struggle for both the independence of Puerto Rico and the struggle of the Puerto Rican Latino community here? Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Jose. Calling from the Bronx, I think. We'll take two more calls. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I want to know, how does Puerto Ricans feel about being statehood? I mean, how can they make Hawaii a state, Alaska a state, yet Puerto Ricans have been trying to be either their own state, or do they, as a people, do they want to be part of this United States? Thank you.
Thank you so very much for calling. We'll take another call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning.
Mariposa, I can hear
this
that voice.
Mariposa from the front. I'm calling. Good morning, Blanca. I'm calling to ask, what can we do, not only to save El Centro, but to prevent the type of leadership that we just had, you know, with the outgoing director, who one of the things that he did, Edwin, he discarded materials. I have a copy of the book Campus in Bondage by Ruth M. Reynolds that was given to me from El Centro. They had stacks of these books in the early 90s, and when El Centro was still really connected to the community. And I learned in a recent meeting of Save El Centro meeting that boxes and boxes of this particular book, and much more, but this is just one example of what was thrown in the garbage under his leadership, under his watch, and under his direction. Campus in Bondage by Ruth M. Reynolds is currently out of print. And this is a book that chronicles how the University of Puerto Rico struggled and student organizing in Puerto Rico. And it's just very strange that that would be a book that would be discarded. It could have been given to members of the community. It could have been sent to prisons. There was a time when El Centro actually had a connection to educating folks who are incarcerated. What can we do to make sure that we don't have a leader like that, that type of reactionary leader?
Thank you very much, Mari.
Also, the archives include the Jesus Colón papers, the Pedro Pietri papers, the Richie Perez papers, the FBI files of more than 41 boxes that former Congressman Serrano acquired to demonstrate the type of surveillance and political persecution under the United States government and the FBI of the Puerto Rican independence movement. And so much more. People should go and see what's available digitally at El Centro's website. And yes, we must fight to save El Centro and to make sure that it is connected to the community. I'll be there tomorrow at the press conference.
Thank you so very much. And there's a question also, two questions coming about whether you knew John Henrik Clark, Blanca. I've got a message here. The late Dr. John Henrik Clark taught Black and Puerto Rican studies at Hunter College, and he was mentored by Afro-Latino Arturo Schomburg. That's from Fahima. And another message from Karen Taylor. So we have very little time left, about 2 minutes. You've got a lot of questions to answer, Blanca.
All right, let me be real quick. Just on Jose's question about how the Centro has a role in what's happening now. Post Maria, what the hurricane did, and we were hit by two hurricanes, right, consecutively, which was so devastating. What it did was it awakened the diaspora in every city and town, practically, right, in Puerto Rico, in the United States, where there was a Puerto Rican population. It really, support groups organized immediately. People brought family up, because they had to. People went down to help family members, so that it really was a tremendous impetus, right, for connecting all the diaspora communities to the island. It really was, the family came together, when disaster hit. So we are connected in a way, that's profound and have remained connected. And it's why the status question is also on the table in a different way, because of the total failure, of the relationship to even
you know, protect people from the aftermath of a hurricane, right? We still don't have full services back on the island. So we're on the map. You know, everybody's on the map now. And there are now, we're in a position where there's more Puerto Ricans in the U.S. than in Puerto Rico. You know, so we are a united, you know, family again. And whatever happens, we're going to, you know, we're mobilized to do it together.
Blanca, we've got about 30 seconds.
And just
maybe you can tell us where is the press conference tomorrow?
All right, tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we're meeting in front of the Silberman School on 119th Street and 3rd Avenue, which is where the Central Library is housed. We're demanding the restoration, right, of resources to Central. We are demanding, as Mariposa talks about, that the Central have that much more intimate relationship and responsive relationship to community and community needs and community demands. And we're demanding that the new central director be chosen with the active participation of stakeholders, right, of faculty, of students, of community, you know, that are devoted, right, to saving the central and growing the central. So tomorrow, 3 at 3rd Avenue, 119th Street, at 1 p.m.
Thank you so very much, Blanca. You've been listening to the voice of Blanca Vasquez, a retired adjunct associate professor in film and media studies who's worked at Hunter College for the last 16 years. She joined the Centro's Oral History Task Force in 1983 and was the founding editor of the Centro Journal in its first 10 years. She's also a veteran of many community struggles, including the Justice Committee of the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights that fought police killings and abuse of power in the Giuliani era. Thank you so very much. Tomorrow, the press conference is at 1 p.m. at 119th Street and 3rd Avenue?
3rd Avenue.
And 3rd Avenue. Thank you very much, Blanca, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Johanna, for having me.
You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:59 and 43 degrees in Central Park this morning, Monday, April 26, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Ajamu Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, Marcos Maldonado Cruz, and Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Them Changes by Thundercat. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you tomorrow.